Welcome to another Avcon WOW Aviation Consulting Company podcast hosted by myself, Paul Ritchie. The reason for this, another Avcon produced podcast, is to bring interesting and relevant news and information to podcast listeners as to things and issues that matter to the aviation industry. For those of us fortunate enough to be part of this industry, we can say that it is never routine, that all of its participants need to be able to turn on a dime as we navigate through new challenges as they arise. On today's show, the roles are reversed, but I'll be the one to be interviewed, and the one who's leading the interview will be Mr. Wayne Attica, our President and CEO of Avcon WOW Aviation Consulting Company. Thank you, Wayne, for taking the lead to do the interviewing, and I turn it over to you to take it from there.
Fantastic. Thank you, Paul. I'm looking forward to this. I'm looking forward to the opportunity that our listeners get to learn a little bit more about you. And it's always nice when I get the opportunity to put you on the hot seat for a change. So I'm looking forward to that on a personal level as well. So, Paul, aviation is largely seen as a niche business. What attracted you to aviation, airports, airlines, and ground handling specifically?
Well, I can say in all honesty that this bug or this desire or interest in aviation started when I was a teenager. I started to notice aircraft flying over the house and became interested. And talked my parents to take me out to the airport one day, one Sunday afternoon. We had nothing to do and went up to the old Terminal 1, the Toronto Pearson Airport. They have a huge parking garage, overlooked the tarmac, and I was absolutely fascinated by what I saw. Of course, my parents wouldn't take me as often as I'd like, so eventually as I got older, I took the bus, and it was a long trip, bus and subway, to get to the airport. And there I became part of what's known as the plane spotting community. I really wanted to become a pilot, but never really got there other than flying solo in small aircraft because I wore glasses. And at that time, glasses was not acceptable for pilots. Today it's different, of course, but then they were pretty strict. So plane spotting, which led to me traveling overseas to Europe or to Miami or Chicago or Los Angeles or San Francisco, just to go spot aircraft and photograph aircraft. I began to know more and more about them. And became particularly intrigued with one Canadian carrier known at that time as CP Air. And in September of 1977, I was hired to work with them. My dream job to start working for an airline, my favorite airline, probably because of the paint scheme or because it was the underdog. It wasn't the big carrier of the day. And then, of course, that led me to working in the ground handling side of the operation as a station attendant. Start there and work my way up. So that's what got me involved, and I'm still passionate to this very day, more than 40 years later.
Excellent. I mean, an exciting start and background, introduction into aviation. So you you started out as a teenager. You're now an industry veteran. We won't get into the details of that for both of our sakes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you share with our listeners your aviation experience over the years and perhaps share a few of your career highlights?
Well, thank you, Wayne, for that question. So as I mentioned earlier, I started on a ramp as a station attendant or a ramp attendant, looking after aircraft, loading, unloading, servicing. My favorite parts were towing, especially the 747, putting it in the hangar. And I only had a foot and a half of clearance by each wingtip, so you really had to make sure you were right on the ball, or right on the line, to aircraft de-icing. And from there, I got interested in the training component. As the airport got busier, it became evident to me that seat-of-the-pants training would not necessarily suffice. So I ended up becoming an acting training supervisor to train my peers. And then really got into it and found it to be my calling at the time is how can I help my colleagues do a better job and a safer job. And eventually the job became full-time. I then became a full-time training supervisor and introduced new concepts. Online training was, of course, that these days consisted of slides. You look at the slides and talk about them. Nothing like we have today, but, using the resources that we had, and you know, building simulators in a way of tools to practice docking low loaders, to specialized toolbars to push around, to understand how not to oversteer an aircraft on a pushback and therefore jackknife it and what have you. From there, I ended up starting up a brand new department at that time called Cabin Services for CPR. And that involved hiring 180 people and having a team of 10 supervisors and one training supervisor and myself. And we had to train everybody and get that set up and how to groom and service aircraft, including doing what are called combi conversions. A combi conversion is when you have part or all of the airplane as cargo, and then you put it back into a passenger aircraft by taking seats out, putting seats back in, whatever the case might be. And I had 45 days to hire 180 people and train everybody and take over the operation as the head of
Wow,
the department.
fascinating.
And I was successful. The first 4 days, we didn't have a single delay charged to the new department. So senior management was very happy. And I really had a good team. So I was really enjoying that. And then I got drawn away from that and was asked to join a team for the then Canadian Airlines International to put together a new Terminal 3 at Toronto Pearson from the airline point of view. And the airline would be the major tenant of a first new terminal in Toronto Pearson for a long time. And it was privately developed at the time as well, privately financed. And my role was to look after all things airside. So whether it be the ramp operations to ground operations control to aircraft painting, line markings, so the case might be. And I really wanted to make sure I did the best of the best, so I was able to convince my boss to allow me to travel to go visit other airports to see what they were doing, other airlines. So in 10 days, I traveled around the world, and I traveled from Toronto to Memphis, Memphis to New York, New York to Zurich, Zurich to London, London to Amsterdam, Amsterdam to Kuwait, 1 month before the invasion to the day. So I'm glad it wasn't 1 month later. From Kuwait to Singapore, Singapore to Bangkok, Bangkok to Hong Kong, Hong Kong to Vancouver, and Vancouver to Toronto in 10 days. So that was 27 time zones and 44 hours on airplanes during that time traveling. I was a lot younger then, so I could handle it. And it was really fascinating to see what worked and what didn't work. And then took that knowledge and applied that to get the best of the best at the time at Terminal 3, whether it be an aircraft docking guidance systems, whether it be PCA at 400 hertz, whether it be how you manage limited ramp space, whether it be to training, and what have you. And it was certainly fun. We were practicing before the building would open to aircraft movement, and I had at 2 a.m. in the morning had 11 aircraft towed over to the new terminal for the first time, including 767s, DC-10, 737s, F-28s, and then actually had live pushbacks. They had multiple combinations looking for jet blast contours, proper wingtip clearance, visibility, nighttime, and what have you. And it was really fascinating to oversee that and watch it come together, which allowed a flawless opening. From there, I got into aircraft de-icing because, frankly, the airline was not very good at it. I mean, they were safe, but they weren't very efficient. So there are many, many delays when it snowed, whether it be Toronto or somewhere else. And I put together a proposal and sent it to the senior VP of ops as, I think we should do this. Much to my surprise, he came back to me and said, "Well, come out to Vancouver, talk to me about it." I think, uh-oh, am I going to be fired or what? So I walked into his office. He said, "I read your plan. I like your plan. You need $2 million. Done. You got it. Go do it." So I was so shocked that he would allow me to do it. And that led me into the de-icing system-wide responsibilities. Lots of travel, lots of training. So we went system-wide and ended up coming to have one of the best operations in North America before CDFs existed. So, off-gate de-icing at the hard stand or on-gate de-icing. And what have you. We pioneered engines on, and that was new to the industry. And we put together the first de-icing manual that was new to the industry, formalized training that was new to the industry, and what have you. We called the Icers Ice Busters. They had a special crest on their parka to show their skill set and build up a team of highly enthusiastic people. So from there, I decided to make a change and leave the airline after 19 years. The airline was struggling as to its survivability. And I went to Toronto Pearson Airport to lead the development of the most exciting project of my life, and that was the central de-icing facility itself. It was a real challenge. And, as you know, Wayne, you were involved in that process. And I know the biggest challenge was how do we design it such that when you can't see in front of your face because the snow is so heavy, how do you know we're up to 24 or 26 airplanes are at any one time, plus 30 trucks, you know, that could be in movement, how to keep everybody safe. So that was the biggest challenge, how to build that. And I also will remember the winter storm of January 2nd, 1999, when Mel Lasvik called in the Army to dig out Toronto, and how we were watching type 4 fluid fail in front of our eyes, or type 1 before we could get the anti-ice, actually, and how we overcame that, and it required a lot. From there, I went on to being a major role in the development of a new Toronto Pearson Terminal 1. We had to train, I had to oversee the training of 4,000 staff. We built a large-scale model, have people understand how the terminal would operate before it was built. We found or bought or recruited 10,000 used pieces of baggage to test the baggage handling system. We did testing of the facility before it opened with 1,200 volunteers, members of the public, pretending they were passengers. I wrote the operations manual, so I had a team write them for me, 5 different manuals, how to operate the terminal building, and then test it all. Finally, from there, I went to strategic development to support the airport authority, help support the development of the airport master plan, and to develop what's known as the Southern Interior Airport Network. That's where smaller airports surround Toronto Pearson, how to get work together with Pearson amongst themselves to grow the aviation pie. So that's a long story as to some of my background. A really exciting, very fortunate background that I was able to experience.
I mean, you know, expose you, you know, to all facets of both the airline and the ground handling side of the business, but also to the operating of airports and terminal buildings, and seeing the terminal building from scratch, strategic planning. So you know, quite an eclectic background that was very good. You know, your travel on, you know, through the 27 time zones in 44 hours, that is a heck of a way to try and avoid jet lag. You know, I don't think I would recommend that to my friends.
Well, let's put it this way. I went to my doctor and said, give me sleeping pills to knock me out on the airplane, right? So if I didn't do that, it'd be a basket case. It took me about 3 days to recover by the time I got back to
Toronto. Absolutely. I don't think I don't think we'll recommend that as an industry best practice, Paul, as we go forward. Moving away from the industry for a second, you know, outside of aviation, you have a varied set of interests as well and responsibilities. Which I think our listeners will find very interesting, and you know. So, can you enlighten us as to what they are and how they impact you as a person, along with your business values, beliefs, and interests?
Well, certainly, one of the things I'm very passionate about is photography. Photography is an art. It's not just a matter of point and shoot and hope you get something. Not to say that I'm a fantastic photographer, because I'm not. I still have a lot to learn. But it's to be able to share with people images that are of interest to them, whether they be family and friends, whether they be community activities, whether they be documentary images, whether they be the beauty of Canada or the beauty of other places in the world, landscape, nature, city design, or it could be capturing struggles of people. It could be traffic, and it could be sad moment in people's lives, funerals, or, you know, very happy times, weddings, or the birth of a child, or raising children. So it's, you know, my photography is to bring emotion and to bring experiences and to bring joy, or to help people question things or ask things through my pictures, and to be able to share it with those that might be interested, whether it be on social media or whether it be through publications. I certainly have had my photography published in a wide range of publications over the years. Specialized publications, nothing like Life or anything along that line. That's for people well above my grade. But to be able to share it. The second thing is our young people, youth, children. I'm a big believer of, if we don't look after our children or help look after children and only leave it up to the parents, that might not always be in the best long-term interest, because today's children are tomorrow's leaders. Just as we look towards others before our time when we were children, and eventually we became adults and had to take on responsibility. So I ended up forming back in 1999 a new youth movement, and I wanted something better for my son at the time, which I now call it a Federation of North American Explorers. So it's a scouting-like youth movement. It has one program for boys, one program for girls. And it focuses on leadership development. Now, not everyone is a natural leader for people, but people lead in something, whether it be music, whether it be art, whether it be acting, whether it be building or working with their hands, or leading people. Everyone leads in something. So the question is, how can we develop that leadership skill in that child for their particular area? I mean, if I compare Johnny to Frank, it's Johnny to Johnny. So, you know, how can that child develop? Because everyone is unique. Everyone comes with their own strengths and weaknesses. Also, to rediscover, especially in today's day and age, the outdoors, get away from the computers, to be out there to swim and to canoe, or to be out in the middle of nature and have a thunderstorm go through. Boy, oh boy, you really realize how small you are when you're in the middle of nowhere and you have a big rain, windstorm, thunderstorm go through. It's quite the experience. Or realizing the joy of helping other people through service, whether you visit seniors, or you visit people that are sick in the hospital, or you feed the homeless downtown, or you simply help one another because you know it's the right thing to do. And then to teach our youth and to encourage them to take on responsibility, that the yes is a yes, the no is a no, a promise is a promise, a commitment is a commitment, a loyalty, finish what you start. And then self-discipline, you know, through wearing of a uniform that could be viewed to be unique. So therefore, you have to have the courage to be different, not just follow society blindly, but to choose the right path or your path and stick to it. And then to include God in your lives, because often God is not necessarily talked about or is engaged to discover the joy of love and helping others and, you know, following God's commandments. So that's been very, very, very engaging, is to travel at many places with my youth. We've been to Italy, we've been to France, we've been to the United States, and we have plans to go to Israel. So we have the opportunity to also do international travel. And so what are the benefits, you know, what are the benefits that, I guess, fall back into one's career? Well, they're actually very significant, because it's win-win. If you give, you always receive. You receive what you give, or not, as the case might be. But it certainly helped me how to improve my communication skills and to communicate with a wide range of people, from very young to very senior, to politicians, religious leaders, to presidents of companies, to frontline employees. So how to communicate. And planning. If you don't plan, you go by the seat of your pants, the results can often be disappointing. Or how to solve problems collectively, not as an individual. You think you have the only one have the answer. But to try to strive for consensus, or at least agree what the problem is. And then to set priorities. I mean, there's so many things that demand your time. And we know the one resource we can never recover is time. When it's gone, it's gone, it's gone, is it? So it's taught me how to set priorities and to manage time. I still have a lot to learn. I don't pretend to be an expert, but certainly I've become much better at it than I was even 5 years ago. And then documentation. How do you document things? How do you communicate things in writing, or how do you present, to help the audience, or in this case, our case, our clients, those of you who want to help actually understand what's being shared or useful. And hard work. Anything good, anything worthwhile requires hard work. But you, again, use the time wisely. And then to be honest, honesty is everything. People want to cheat. When I think they're getting away with something, they actually get away with nothing. And my experience is being those companies and businesses that truly are honest actually do quite well, because to find people that are honest is not always easy. And then clarity, what's the point you're trying to make? And so clarity, I started learning with young people, and it applies to all ages, is clarity. So that's how I would respond to that question.
Wow, I think I need a nap, but just listening to you, it really is quite amazing, because the industry is all encompassing and it really is intense, and it demands a lot from all of us that work in it, and for you to find the time to deliver quality service, to the young people and the explorers in your life, to deliver the life lessons and the photography is quite amazing. Without your time management, I don't think you could fit it all into your time frame. So it, very, very well done. The life lessons are excellent. I find that when you give, you not only receive, you actually receive 3 to 10-fold, when you give. So if more people give, the more you get back. So excellent lessons. Thank you for sharing that with all of us. Let's move back to the industry again. And a little closer to home for both of us is, what was behind you coming to work for Avcon WW Inc. and known as Avcon WOW, and in the aviation consulting as our vice president of operations?
Well, I'd say that after 40 years in the industry, 19 in a major air carrier and 21 at Canada's largest airport, I thought I had something to share my expertise and experiences with others. And especially when it comes from an operations perspective, I mean, that's my area of strength. And of course, planning and organizing that to make it work. And so, fortunately, I've had, it's not much I haven't seen. I've seen aircraft crashes that have happened. Some that have been a miracle, especially the Air France in Toronto. No one lost their lives. No one was seriously hurt. But I was with the passengers after they came off the aircraft and they went to the terminal building before they were able to reunite with the passengers, sorry, with the families. It was a very humbling experience to be able to deal with people who lost their baggage and almost lost their life, and to go through such a traumatic experience, and their courage and their sometimes shock, and to hold their hands and to be with them and to seek help from others that if they needed it. So that's certainly something that stuck with me and really got me going into, okay, well, how do we prepare for an emergency? Even me at camp, okay, how do I prepare for an emergency? How do I keep my camper safe and secure? And if something does go wrong, what do you do? How do you do it? But on an airport, it's a much larger scale. What's the primary system? What's the backup? What's the backup to the backup? And what do you do if something goes wrong? So plans of operations along that line, certainly passenger handling. And I've seen it from both sides. As a passenger, when it really goes well, great. If it really goes poorly, then something I remember, and I look at what can be done to avoid this incident in the first place. And it often comes down to communication. So passenger handling, dangerous goods. We ship a lot of stuff on airplanes, and if people aren't paying attention, and tragically it has happened on some cargo aircraft, even some passenger aircraft, and things were loaded in the wrong places or incorrectly or shouldn't have been on the airplane at all, and it started a fire, and some cases, the entire airplane was lost. So dangerous goods handling, aircraft de-icing, we'll talk more about that later on probably, but the passion for efficiency and safety. I'll never forget the Air Ontario crash in Dryden, Ontario, or the Air Florida crash in Washington, or the Air Aurora crash in Newfoundland are three examples that could have been totally avoided had the aircraft been de-iced, anti-iced properly, and loss of human life. So I never ever wanted to be in that situation, or people that were involved in actual aircraft de-icing. I have had, you know, the tragic experience of having three of my peers at another airport lose their life in a de-icing accident because of failure to follow a procedure on two key parties. So it certainly has got me very focused on safety. SMS is a big deal for us, and I've seen the results of things going wrong, and I'm passionate about safety. And then aircraft servicing. Now, how do we serve aircraft efficiently and safely and not kill the person in the process? I don't mean physically, but, you know, their back hurts or they injure their hand or they get easily tired. So how do we do that well? And then overall airport operations, from baggage systems to passenger boarding bridges to air passenger flows to security issues to retail and what have you. I've seen it all, and you know, there are many opportunities, especially at smaller airports, meaning that if they get it right, they can grow the facility and they can meet the customer needs and not waste space. So all that passion and experience, I want to share. And, you know, working with former peers like yourself, we and I have worked together on and off throughout the years in the industry. We certainly have different opinions from time to time. We've always, you know, been able to respect a different point of view and often found a way to be able to make it work. So ultimately, my goal through AVCON and its mission value statements is to help aviation-based businesses expand and grow profitably. And not that we take the money and they get a nice book and it sits on the shelf and they get nothing out of it. We really need to see them succeed, because they succeed, we succeed. And of course, you know, we have a high set of values and ideals and that we want to bring to our clients. And these are values and ideals that I support and I'm proud to be part of. And that's the reason why I chose to move out of the day-to-day operation to try my hand at consulting. And I'm having fun most of the time.
Excellent. Fascinating. you know, and you know, your comments about a passenger, you know, your experience as a passenger is exceptionally, you know, well taken. I can remember in my past life working for Ward Air, and when Max Ward was coming into the station that I was running, and he would fly in at the time on one of our competitors' aircraft, I could always tell what kind of service they gave, because if they gave exemplary service, he was in a terrible mood because the competitors were giving excellent
better
service.
Better than Ward
okay.
Air, yeah.
Yeah, if he and if he got off the airplane, you know, and he had a big smile on his face, I knew that less than exemplary by the competition. So, you know, we all pay attention to it, you know, regardless of where we are in our walks of life. You brought up some very interesting points on de-icing that you just touched on. Can you share with the listeners a little more about your experience in aircraft de-icing and where you see trends and future needs being met in that field?
Certainly, that's been one of my biggest joy in my career, is to be given the opportunity to lead the development and then the testing and then the implementation and then the operation through a service provider, which, Wayne, of course, you led for the centralized de-icing facility at Toronto Pearson International Airport. It was and largest still is one of the largest in the world, 65 acres. Cost of $65 million to build back in 1998. That was a lot of money. It's still a lot of money to this day. But I really was able to convince my colleagues to build it right. I said, running a de-icing facility is like a war. You can't afford to lose the battle, because then you lose a war in this case, because you can't make a mistake. And you have to assume things will go wrong. And so what are you going to do to overcome that? So it came down to things like inset lighting for a facility to be used frequently during major snowfall events. So the pilot could see where to put the nose wheel. You can paint all the yellow lines you like, but if the yellow lines get covered in snow, you can't see a squat, and therefore you want to make sure the airplane is exactly where it needs to be, because you don't have a lot of wingtip clearances. Or simply managing the fluid, a lot of glycol. We can imagine you spray 15,000-16,000 airplanes in one season. That's a lot of activity. So how do you protect the environment? How do you make sure the glycol doesn't get into natural waterways? What do you do for that fluid? How do you keep the cost down? Were some things we had to consider. And of course, safety. I talked about the other incident that we experienced. We lost three of my colleagues, and the pain and trauma for their families, of course, and the whole company was very, 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 very significant. So safety is always number one on the list. So how do we manage that, especially if you're in a heated operation and you have visibility problems and you have potential fatigue and you have equipment reliability, and how to supply glycol quickly to keep the battle going, and how to rotate staff and all that stuff. But if I look at the future trends of de-icing, I think one of the biggest challenges is staff training. How do you effectively train someone? Because spraying glycol is expensive and time consuming. And so what can be used, and what type of knowledge does an operator need? And how do you retain that skilled operator? I mean, the de-icing trucks, especially if you use something like an Elephant Beta, which is one of the most advanced vehicles in the marketplace, also very expensive, about $1 million per truck. It takes skills to be able to manipulate feet and both hands at the same time and drive the vehicle. So how do you retain that highly skilled employee? And then, of course, overall efficiency. Think about it this way. The 767 was the primary wide-bodied aircraft when the CDF opened. The odd DC-10 and 747, they were big, of course. But the 767 was replaced by the 787. The 787 has a wing root area that's about 35% bigger than the 767. Now, you don't have more to de-ice on the airplane, and you have more aircraft demanding to go through the facility. So how do you do that? How do you improve efficiency without compromising safety? So that's a real challenge that de-icing operators face. And then, of course, costs. I mean, people are looking for a cost-effective operation. No, it's not free, but it has to be competitive. So how do you manage the cost? And then, of course, the trucks. How do you ensure the trucks are reliable? And how do you make sure you get long-term use out of it? So if you make an investment of $1 million in a truck, you want 20 years out of that truck at least, in order to get a return on your investment. So how do you make sure the truck actually can do it and last that long? Or even post-aircraft de-icing, what do you do? How do you make sure the plane's clean? It's snowing or it's poor visibility. How do you know the airplane's actually clean? There's no clear ice. And then, of course, verbal communication can be misunderstood. So now we're moving to digital communication, and even in ATC, less and less verbal, more digital information. So how do we provide digital information? When does the holdover time start? What type of fluid was used? How much fluid was sprayed? Is the equipment clear? To give information to the pilot in command, to dispatch the pilot in command from that location. What do you do if it fails? Does the computer crashes? What's your backup? Also the efficiency of applying fluid. Now, none of these are new per se, but the importance is increasing as the demand increases post-COVID. We get back to where we were before, and the aircraft wings get bigger and bigger and bigger because that's efficiency. That reduces fuel burn and raffle lighter weight and all that stuff. Different composites are made, so where can you spray, where can't you spray. So there are a lot of challenges that are out there that we think we can help with. And it's pretty exciting, actually, because it is an ongoing evolution. If I look where de-icing was when the first DC-8 came out in 1960, and with a water hose on top of a truck with a bucket, maybe. And you'd spray it like a water hose, and eventually the slush would fall off, and eventually the airplane would may not be fully clean. And anti-icing fluid didn't even exist. So we've come such a long way, but we still have a long way to go to really, you know, make it smooth can be. It doesn't matter what size airport you are. The challenges are similar, but the scale is different. So these are my thoughts on aircraft de-icing in the future.
No, absolutely, Paul. I mean, you know, one thing that people don't realize is you know, when the CDF first started back in 1998, you know, data transfer was in its infancy. And when you're handling 26 airplanes at one time, verbal communication can get exceptionally confusing and noisy and you know, very, very challenging. So you know, the CDF, had to look at ways to pass information, you know, in a timely, you know, manner, you know, so it was very state of the art, you know, where it was heading forward, you know, environmentally, you know, today, you know, the one challenge that the industry is always under fire for being environmentally unfriendly. And you know, de-icing is no different, and the search continues as it does for sustainable, you know, aviation fuels. Also, you know, the search for sustainable glycols, you know, to de-ice airplanes, you know, and you know, with less toxic substances is always, you know, there. So there is a long, long way to go. You touched on COVID, and you know, the pandemic has hit every walk of life hard, and the aviation industry was one of the hardest hits, and suffered tremendously with a 90% drop of you know, in business and activity, and trying to keep companies afloat. So everybody was impacted, but many of the smaller airports, you know, have been hit particularly hard. What are your thoughts on the needs, challenges, and opportunities for airports such as these to move forward?
I'm a big believer is never to let a major downturn not be used as an opportunity to be able to reset, an opportunity to be able to look at new ways of offering services or making the airport more relevant. As people have withdrawn due to lockdowns and overall general discomfort, or in some cases fear of this pandemic, any thought about traveling anywhere has been pushed out of their mind to a large extent, and the appetite has not yet returned. And so in smaller airports, the airports sometimes is completely forgotten about, whether it be by local politicians or whether it be by the local people. And it's just something that happens to be there, and maybe for, you know, people that fly for the fun of it, maybe it's only good for them. But in reality, and history has shown in the past, and it will again in the future, even back to the end of World War II, how important airports were. You look at the Berlin airlift, because they had airports, they could stop people from being starved when Berlin was cut off from the rest of East Germany by the Soviets at the time. And same thing applies to local communities for different reasons. So how does a small airport take the airport and get the community to realize the economic benefit to the community is very significant? Because airports generally generate better paying jobs, encourage trade, encourage tourism, encourage the local development. I remember under SOAM, we did a study once, as the SOAM means the Southern Ontario Airport Network, it was led then by the GTAA, as to communities who did not have an airport, often did not generate key businesses choosing to locate at that airport. For example, there's a small airport just east of Toronto, which is, for private aircraft. And there is an owner of three factories, that produce that manufacture products. And the only reason why these three factories are there is because the owner can fly into and inspect and to have meetings and to help drive the business. If the airport was not there, the owner of the business said that, then he would sell or close the business and go somewhere else because he couldn't get to and from his business in a practical or reasonable manner. So the idea might be, how do we build partnerships with aviation-related businesses? It could be a form of manufacturing. It could be a maintenance, repair, and overhaul. It could be even doing point-to-point service with small airplanes. So I look at Niagara Falls Airport. Had a small airline of 9-seaters, up to 4 flights a day prior to COVID, flying from Niagara Falls to Billy Bishop. I mean, the drive from Niagara to Toronto is not out of this world. It is in a winter day, but not out of this world. But the flights were well used by business people who, A, didn't want to make the drive and had business downtown Toronto, or B, needed to connect to fly somewhere else out of the island airport, somewhere in Chicago or New York or Thunder Bay or Sudbury or Ottawa or Montreal, would take that service. And so now Niagara had a small service, but a service that was necessary that made their community more attractive to others who might be thinking, especially now when people work more from home. Sometimes they want to be further away from their head office, but want the convenience to get there quickly and easily for the one day a week or for board meetings or the case might be, and we'll maybe want a service like that. So maybe smaller airports could pursue carriers like Cape Air. Cape Air is a unique carrier in the eastern U.S. that fly 9-seaters and 12-seaters aircraft from small cities to a larger one. And they're very profitable, and it really brings keeps that community connected. And maybe it's specialized charters. I know of other smaller cities that have 3 or 5 737 charters. Maybe it's a shopping weekend to New York City. Another could be a weekend junket to Las Vegas. Another could be a long weekend in northern Florida to play golf. So there are possibilities there of specialized charter flights to meet local needs and make it more attractive, right? And what have you. Or maybe it's business jets. I mentioned earlier about, you know, business people need to have the ease to travel, to do business, or even to go and tend to their vacation. So maybe it's to fly to go skiing, for example. Business people that are very successful, they work hard, they play hard too. And so if they can get to a local area for tourism, whether it's golf or sailing or fishing, if they get into your airport, that will draw more high-paying people that want to support your tourism or services. Or maybe we see the growth in aviation. Might not be growing now, but it will be again. And there's a huge shortage of pilots as baby boomers more and more retire or have had enough of it. Or even how to maintain and fix airplanes. SMEs, subject matter experts or engineers or avionics. And you know, you need an airport to do that training. So I think, you know, there are many opportunities, but airports need to rethink about, okay, who am I going to partner with? What businesses are they going to partner with? What are their actual needs? So if you get the service, how are you going to make sure it's actually being maintained? You know, at one point, if you look at London, Ontario, as an example, when things return to normal, and hopefully in a year or less, there are a lot of people that are retired that live in that community that have English descent or background or family, might very well be interested in once every 2 week charter flight using the new A321 long range aircraft or A320 to fly from there to London or Stansted or Dublin or Amsterdam. And then be able to have that movement of people and goods. And of course, cargo. People want anything tomorrow. So there's a lot of demand for cargo. We certainly see that if more airlines convert aircraft into cargo, especially in Canada. So smaller airports also have the needs for cargo. So maybe they could set up some sort of a partnership with smaller cargo carriers to move goods. Maybe that tied into the larger Amazon or tied into Canada Post or whatever the case might be, partnerships. But airports, you know, if you want to have a better service for your people and you want to improve e-commerce, especially if you have something to offer and you want to ship it out, the airport becomes important. To drive it in a truck, to drive it to a place like Toronto, and to get stuck in traffic and it takes a long time to get there, it's not always the best way. So that's why I'm optimistic about the future of small airports. And now is the time to think about your mission and vision and needs, and then put a stake in the ground and go for it. That's my comment on that topic.
Excellent. No, I think that you know, you've covered a lot there that people can do, and the key is collaboration between the community, the people, the business community, local governments, and the airport working together can make the future a whole lot brighter as we come out of the pandemic and move forward.
Absolutely. And so people need to be creative and they need to partner. Yeah. The days of doing your own thing and not caring what somebody else is doing is not necessarily the wisest path going forward.
No, absolutely. Aircraft need to be serviced. We've talked about the de-icing side. We've talked, but aircraft need to be serviced and supported on arrivals, for departures, to get people on their way, be it an airliner or a business, a corporate jet, a private, passenger plane. Where do you see the needs or opportunities as to this aspect of the industry headed?
Well, if we look at aircraft servicing, one of the areas where there's been the least amount of development, in my opinion, is aircraft servicing. You look at when the 747 first came out in 1969, the first wide bodies, when we first were getting into lower unit load devices, ULDs, to offload and offload. And then you look at the 747-8, a very modern version. It's the same process. Nothing's really changed. Maybe it's time for change. There are many challenges in the industry today and in life in general. And that is to get people who actually want to work. Get people who are willing to do physical work, shift work, working in the rain, working in the heat, working in the cold. It's difficult. So what's the mentality? Is it the title you give them? Is it you give them greater opportunities in career development? Is it that you cross-utilize them? Is it that you emphasize the importance of a team? Is it that we look at new equipment? Is it we look for ways to reduce the manual labor, like bulk loading the 737 MAX aircraft? Look at the 737 MAX 10 with 220 people, whatever you get on that airplane. That's a lot of bags, say. Eh? So cargo, how do you manage that more efficiently? And then, of course, e-equipment, the environment. We all need to be concerned about the environment. And so what can an airport do to reduce pollution? First of all, is to have e-equipment. But then is the airport infrastructure organized for that? Is it convenient or is it a hassle? Is it supported or is it an exception? So how can the future of e-equipment replace fossil fuel equipment to improve your overall environmental point of view? And then things do go wrong. You have a thunderstorm goes through. No, you can't service the aircraft because of the safety of the ramp crew as there's lightning overhead. But how do you communicate? How do you work together? How do you deal with poor weather conditions? How do you cross-utilize staff? How do you share resources or knowledge amongst different agencies, whether it be customs or immigration or security screening or passenger check-in or keeping the store open longer because the flight's delayed? How can that be better managed, even at a small airport? And how do we communicate? It all tied back to aircraft servicing. So if it takes forever for the bag to come, people don't know what's going on, get excited about the fact the bag isn't arriving. So can we communicate that to them? Or can plans be made to have a more direct line from the offload to the inbound baggage belt? That's not so much an issue of a small airport, but it's more of an issue of a medium or a large airport. Or maybe it's staff productivity. People, run from gate to gate to gate. Is that really the best way, or do they stay in one gate, or do we share resources amongst agencies? Is it equipment? Is it sometimes people? What is it? Especially as human resources become less available. And then even things like financing of equipment. Equipment is not cheap. Anything to do with aviation seems to have an extra premium on it for cost to buy it or to lease it. How can that equipment be financed and make it more affordable? Or even, it's shouldn't be a race to the bottom. How little do I have to pay my staff in order to win the contract? So as cheap as possible, but there are costs to that. There are costs of staff turnover, there's cost of aircraft damage, there's cost of poor service levels, there's cost of lack of enthusiasm or dedication on the part of the staff that are there. And money's not everything. It's also the environment and it's the attitude and it's how they're treated and how they're communicated with. Or even smaller airports, maybe taking cross-utilized staff to the staff to cut grass and plow snow or whatever, when there are no aircraft on the ground, could very well be the same staff that service the airplane and then go back to every function. So if you only have 3, 4, or 5 flights a day, how do you do that? How do you do that cost effectively and have the passion and dedication to keep people employed? So I think there's a lot of opportunities there, a lot of needs, but I also know there are no simple answers. If there were simple answers, we would have figured out a long time ago, and we would have done it. One airport tribe was called Combi System. Combi System was you had a potable water and labs and PCA units built it into the ramp surface itself. And so the bosses would come up when they're needed, and you connect the hoses to the airplane, and then it disappeared, and you have a clean apron. It looked very intriguing, but it was a problem when it was cold and there was ice, or the airplane sizes and dimensions changed and all the boxes were in the wrong location. But it was creative. Who's being creative today? Who's being daring today? Who's establishing the task force and within the industry as a whole to say, what can we do different? What can we do better? Where can we test it? Where can we experiment it? Can we find funding from government sources or universities or somewhere to try new ways and new equipment and new processes? How can we work with the aircraft manufacturer for the next generation of aircraft? How do we make it less manpower intensive? Why isn't a 737 MAX containerized? American Airlines used to operate 707s, 123Bs, and 707-300s. Very old and ancient aircraft, first flew in 1957, entered service 1960 or so, 1959. And their aircraft were one airline that was containerized. So to offload the airplane took 10 minutes. But to offload it manually took 40 minutes, plus a lot more staff. So something to think about, how can we work together and how can we do better and smarter and take care of the staff that are involved and keep them engaged.
Yeah, very, very well put, Paul. I mean, safety, is just throughout in all aspects of aviation, and it's got to be uppermost in people's minds. The pandemic has hit the aviation and travel industry harder than most industries, as I mentioned previously.
Yeah.
What, if anything, different can the industry help itself propel forward in a safe, responsible, cost-effective, and environmentally responsible manner? We offer, what we call revenue engineering, which is based on revenue science, to help companies with the onboarding of people and the most productive method of operating, and then how to generate additional revenue. You know, so we're trying to be part of that future at Avcon. Wow, but how is the industry overall, you know, going to manage itself going forward in a responsible manner?
Well, I recently posted a little blog or a little thought on that on LinkedIn, and that is one of the biggest challenges we have today as people and the industry tries to recover from the pandemic is everyone seems to be doing their own thing. Airlines worry about the airlines, airports worry about airports, aircraft manufacturers worry about aircraft manufacturers. And I don't see a lot of cross-functional cooperation to rebuild the business together. So it is very much, how do we rebuild confidence that travel is safe? How do we promote the safety measures that are put in place to protect the passengers and crew when you fly from point A to point B? How do we reduce the hassle factor? My gosh, I read on this article I wrote, mentioned to you on LinkedIn, someone I know who is a president of a company, he travels a lot. He says, I traveled recently. I came back and both an arrival and both ends were so terrible. The experience was so awful. I may not choose to fly again if I possibly can avoid it because the lineups, okay, and the waiting. And, you know, you want me to fly to Montreal, but you want me to be there at least 2 hours before. And before I go outside the country, I'll be there 3.5 hours before, because that's how much time it takes. Or I arrive on the airplane, and I can't get off the airplane for an hour and a half because the customs hall was too clogged because of the pandemic restrictions, and I can't tell you when you're going to get through. And it's such a terrible experience. We're shooting ourselves in the foot, okay? People aren't working together. Of course we have to protect everyone involved, but it's got to be a better way. There's got to be a way, whether it's scheduling, whether it's flow, whether it's changing design of terminal buildings, whether it's staffing issues, whether it's new technology. Don't know the answer to these questions offhand, but we got to do this together, and people are not doing it together. At least that's the impression I get. Just reading what I'm reading and what I'm hearing from people that are actually traveling. It's got to the point, even I don't want to get on an airplane and travel internationally because I don't want to face that nightmare. You know, you're on a flight in 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 hours and you're exhausted. All you want to do is get off the airplane and go home. But if I have to wait 3 hours, 90 minutes just to get to the baggage room to get my bag, not interested. So we got to fix it. The industry's got to fix it. And we got to work together to do it. We got to work together to rebuild interest in the industry. We got to rebuild getting people to travel for business and for leisure and for visiting family and relatives or sightseeing or tourism. We have to do a better job to build back that is actually better than it was before, but the experience is very poor right now. That's a key area that people have to focus on. And then of course, we got to look at, all right, what do we do? I mentioned earlier about staffing and about e-equipment and looking after the environment. That can't be just one party. It's got to be all of us working on that together. But who's going to do it? Who's going to lead it? Who's going to want to be part of it? I suggest to the listeners, if we keep operating in our own silos and only worry about ourselves and don't care about the other guy that's their problem, I think we're really losing out on an opportunity that's going to hurt the industry longer term.
Absolutely, Paul. The problem is, you know, pre-COVID, we were in a competitive, every man for himself, winner-take-all mentality. And there's many people that think we're going to go back to that. It's just not going to work. We need to move into an infinite mindset. And in an infinite mindset, you know, the game, life is ongoing. We have a part to play, and we need to work together. You know, competitors need to become worthy rivals that we learn from and we build together, you know, from, you know, each other's best practices, as opposed to that we're trying to, you know, put them out of business or they're trying to put us out of business. We need to get into far more blue ocean thinking, you know, to move forward in the industry.
There's always always be room for competition. And competition is very important. And it's very healthy.
No, I agree, but it can't be a dog eat dog competition. It's got to be, you know, a collaborative, you know, competition moving forward, and the industry, you know, has to, you know, collectively move itself forward to bring the world closer together and to take advantage of the abundance, you know, that is in the world today. People have to become abundant thinker, not small-minded, you know, thinking.
Absolutely. It is called, by working together, we can accomplish a lot more. By working as individuals, not so much.
Absolutely. Paul, this has been fascinating about the industry, but there's one last thing I'd like to cover off. And that, you know, our industry is dependent on getting people interested in travel, be it for business or leisure. Yet so many people are suffering from the pandemic restrictions, economic fallout, mental fatigue, you know, from the isolation. And that, you know, now that people are becoming vaccinated and the world is becoming safer again, okay, I understand that you're involved with building a new movement called People Power Forward. Can you briefly talk about this and how PPF may, in the long term, help aviation?
Thank you for the opportunity, Wayne. People Power Forward is an idea that I came up with initially, but fortunately I have some very strong people that are willing to help. And is there a way to develop a tool or a mechanism that people can help each other directly and indirectly by sharing ideas or resources for a mutual benefit? And imagine if we're all walking in the same direction to make our lives better for our families. And if our lives are better for our families, then it's better for the economy. And the economy gets healthier and allows more trade, which allows more people in other countries to also benefit. And it has a positive domino impact. So People Power Forward is not a government agency. It's not a religion. It's not a social movement. It's not trying to sell something. It doesn't have a hidden agenda. It's not owned by somebody. It's structured as a co-op or as a cooperative. And it means just that, to cooperate and to help one another. But there's some core beliefs that we have to bring some comfort to those who might be interested as this movement grows. And by movement, we mean that the experience and opportunity will impact people for a long period of time, and maybe even for the rest of their natural lives, if they're able to turn things around and see hope in the future and not fall into despair or frustration or despair. Yeah, as I said, despair earlier, but just to have some way forward. So we have some beliefs that enables the vision of People Power Forward. First of all, what we're going through right now, it will pass. It's not forever. It might seem like forever. It certainly does to me at the moment, but it will pass. And then, of course, we'll stay safe. Because if we don't stay safe, then, you know, people will be afraid to do anything. So how do we manage that? And then the importance of socialization. Now, we are social beings. We're not meant to be isolated in our home. And socialization is an important part or component of our life. And it will continue to be so. So People Power Forward will help promote that. But also at the same time, we have to recognize that people, you know, people are capable and they're creative and they are resilient. And we can adapt and we can overcome. So with that thought in mind, We can move forward with a degree of confidence. Also, that everyone, every human being is valued and can contribute to success. So it's not I'm the victim and you need to rescue me and you need to take care of me and I'll just take whatever you give me and do nothing. No, people power forward is you need to also contribute towards your own success. And then finally, people walking together towards a new life, meaning that we're trying to improve for our families. That's our first priority. And the rest will come as we look for ways to be able to help others as we move forward. So, you know, basically, people power forward, the mission statement is simple. It's people helping people recover to renew and build through process and teamwork for a better tomorrow. And how's that done? Well, we still are in the early stages, but it's to provide a forum or a mechanism for people to share ideas, to gather information, to express concerns. It could be, how do I help my child who has to learn online and not in person? What are there any tips or techniques? Or is there parent coaching? Is there coaching for my child? Is there anyone that exists in my community? How can we work with like-minded parents? It could be I have a small business idea. Would people be interested in this type of service? Do I have any examples that I can find and look at? Are there any potential partners? Or it could be we want to support the local small business because the local small businesses are profitable. They buy your services of bigger companies. So not the big companies that can do it by themselves, the small companies, small employers that end up really supporting and feeding the larger health and growth of our community. That ties back to aviation. If people are content, and if people see hope, and if people can work together, then they also will want to travel, and they will want a vacation, and they want to do more business, and they want to meet face-to-face. And that's very important to aviation, to hotels, to taxi drivers, to tourist attractions, to restaurant workers, to all of us, because we're all connected. You know, we're all connected. And then, you know, to provide overall support. So we still are in the fairly early stages, but we are optimistic that we can do something to help one another. Not necessarily me personally, but it's to be able to contribute something that may benefit others down the road. That's where we are. That's what we hope to be able to do through People Power Forward.
Fascinating, Paul. That is such a worthy cause. So I wish you every success in your group in putting that together and encourage other people to either join the People Power Forward movement or to form similar groups to help the world come together in a much more meaningful fashion. That brings to conclusion our podcast and the questions that I had, Paul. It's been really fun talking to you and listening to your ideas and thoughts on the industry and beyond. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Wayne, for the opportunity. And listeners of our podcast, we look forward to the next one in the future.